Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the violence that was brought to Charlottesville, Virginia, by the Ku Klux Klan, neo-Nazis, and white nationalist groups under the banner of Unite the Right, who organized a Nazi-like torchlight protest Friday night against the removal of a statue of the Confederate leader Robert E. Lee. Then on Saturday converged on the statue wearing military gear, waving Confederate flags and Nazi swastikas, chanting, "You will not replace us" and "Jews will not replace us" as they clashed with counter-demonstrators. Nicole Hemmer, a professor at the Miller Center for Public Affairs at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville and author of Messenger of the Right, Conservative Media, and the Transformation of American Politics, joins us to discuss her article at U.S. News & World Report, Sounds and Silence in Charlottesville, The Violence of White Nationalism Spilled Onto the Streets of Virginia, and what she witnessed after a car driven by a white supremacist plowed into a crowd of demonstrators celebrating the dispersal of the Unite the Right demonstrators. Then we will speak with sociologist Randy Blazak, chair of the Coalition Against Hate Crime, which monitors hate crimes in the state of Oregon, and a professor at the University of Oregon and author of Hate Offenders. He joins us to challenge the troubling remarks by the President of the United States that implied liberals and conservatives are equally violent when Trump went out of his way to emphasize that the hate, bigotry, and violence on display in Charlottesville came from many sides. We will discuss what is clear, and that is that there are members of the alt-right in the highest positions in the Trump White House, and that the alt-right is trying to hijack the discussion about who was the victim of in American history by encouraging the myth that white men are oppressed. Then finally, we will assess the extent to which Trump's threat of military action against Venezuela is playing into the hands of the Maduro government, who have brought Venezuela to the brink of collapse and now, thanks to Trump, can blame the Yankee imperialists who have a sorry history of military intervention in Latin America. Jennifer McCoy, the distinguished professor of political science at Georgia State University and author of International Mediation in Venezuela, joins us to discuss how Trump has set back regional efforts to deal with the worsening tragedy in Venezuela. And joining us now is Nicole Hemmer, a professor at the Miller Center for Public Affairs at the University of Virginia and a research associate at the U.S. Studies Center at the University of Sydney. She is host of the Past Present podcast and author of Messengers of the Right, Conservative Media, and the Transformation of American Politics, and a contributor to U.S. News and World Report, where her latest article is Sounds and Silence in Charlottesville, The Violence of White Nationalism Spilled Onto the Streets of Virginia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nicole Hemmer.
Thank you so much for having me, Ian.
And Nicole, your normally peaceful town, where there's a large campus at which you teach, the University of Virginia, was clearly invaded or disrupted by a alt-right neo-Nazi white nationalist group who organized protests of the removal of a statue of Robert E. Lee in Charlottesville. They brought with them violence, surely. I mean, the president's response is so troubling to so many people just tell us what you witnessed, because it seems pretty clear that that nobody would have died and been injured had this white supremacist rally not happened.
Certainly. I mean, there have been white supremacist rallies in Charlottesville over the course of the last year over this issue of the removal of the statue of Robert E. Lee, and then the broader issue of white nationalism and the continued dominance of white people in Charlottesville politics and American politics. And by the time that I had gotten to the rally yesterday, the rally was supposed to start at noon. I arrived about an hour beforehand, and it had already devolved into a considerable amount of violence. People throwing things, including things that were on fire, pepper spray, all of these sorts of things, people fighting. That was already happening by 11, and in fact had really gotten its start the night before when there was an unauthorized torchlit rally through the campus of the University of Virginia, where members of the alt-right set upon some students who were counter-protesting an anti-racist protest at the statue of Thomas Jefferson, in which several students were attacked by members of the alt-right. So this had already become violent the night before, and I think that by the time everyone started gathering on Saturday, it was clear that trouble was in the air.
Well, what you wrote about in your article, U.S. News and World Report, is pretty alarming, the way you witnessed these white supremacist neo-Nazis beating up a young black man with sticks and clubs, and they had shields, they had military equipment. Many of them had body armor and were carrying assault rifles. And this happened right in front of the police station. So to what extent were the police allowing this violence to happen or somehow being complicit?
Yeah, this is the thing that was perhaps most shocking to me. It first started at Emancipation Park, where the protesters and the white nationalist group were facing off with one another. There were violent clashes that were happening already in the morning, and police weren't intervening. And then as the white nationalists began to march down Market Street here in downtown Charlottesville, they began to clash with anti-racist protesters. Where I was, right outside of a police station in Charlottesville on that street near a parking garage, I watched as a young man was beaten by white nationalists, and there simply wasn't any intervention by the police. And it was one of those things that I don't know if there was a broader theory of crowd control that was going on behind it, but up until the attack by the car later on that afternoon, it was the most violent thing that I had seen, and there was no intervention, which was shocking. I mean, there were so many members of the National Guard, of the state police, of the local police that were gathered there, and there wasn't any action by them. And again, I don't know if there was a larger theory that was going on there for why they weren't acting, but it sent the message that they would watch this violence happen, but not actually intervene, which I think was disturbing for a lot of people there.
And again, I'm speaking with Nicole Hemmer, who's a professor at the Miller Center for Public Affairs at the University of Virginia and a research associate at the U.S. Studies Center at the University of Sydney. She's the host of Past Present podcast and author of Messengers of the Right, Conservative Media and the Transformation of American Politics, and a contributor to U.S. News and World Report, where she has an article, Sounds and Silence in Charlottesville, The Violence of White Nationalism Spilled onto the Streets of Virginia. And of course, the silence I suspect you're referring to is President Trump's response, where he blamed many sides. And that has troubled a lot of people, including a number of Republican senators. But let's talk about the sounds. You were there shortly after the car driven by this young white nationalist member of Vanguard America, James Alex Fields, plowed into a group of protesters who were celebrating the dispersal of the neo-Nazi white nationalists. And this car plowed in at high speed. There's video of it. A 32-year-old young woman from Charlottesville died. 19 people were injured, many of them seriously. It's particularly upsetting. I mean, I have a daughter the same age, so tell me what happened. The sounds must have been hideous of the aftermath of that act of terrorism. To put it bluntly, that was an act of terrorism. I don't see how it's different from what happened in Nice, where the so-called ISIS member of ISIS plowed into a group of revelers in Nice, France.
Well, I think that's what's so stark about this particular attack is that it is so reminiscent of terror attacks that we've seen in Nice and Westminster on London Bridge, and it looked exactly like what we saw after those attacks. There were bodies everywhere. There was blood everywhere. It was something that, I mean, people can look on it online, although I don't recommend that they do, but the aftermath looked like the aftermath of those attacks. And the weapon was the same. The political hostility was there. And so the fact that this hasn't been called by the president or the administration an act of terrorism it's not shocking. I mean, it's what we've come to expect. I mean, we've seen terror attacks against mosques in Quebec here in the United States that have elicited no response from the administration. So we know that their use of the word terrorism is political. But here in Charlottesville, where we have such clear evidence of a politically motivated attack that uses the same kind of weaponry that we've seen in other attacks across the world, that language wouldn't be used. Again, it's not surprising, but I think it is telling.
Well, it's pretty clear that, as I mentioned at the beginning, none of this would have happened had these white nationalists, neo-Nazis, Ku Klux Klansmen not showed up. And this was a protest to unite the right, organized by, I believe, Richard Spencer, a leading white nationalist figure. And David Duke was certainly there, and he was proudly proclaiming to the cameras that we're going to fulfill the promises of Donald Trump to take our country back. Was that the theme, this bizarre idea that somehow white men are oppressed in this country?
That is the overriding theme for this. The rally itself was put together by actually a local alt-right member named Jason Kessler, who has worked with Richard Spencer over the course of the year in various rallies here in Charlottesville. But that's the basic idea, that that white men are being pushed out and that they're not going to allow their place to be disrupted. And the way that they're going to make that stand is around these Confederate statues, which apparently they're holding up as the true legacy of white men in the United States. Now, as a historian, that's a pretty telling choice, right? Because they're choosing to rally around these statues of men who actually rebelled against the United States in order to defend the institution of slavery. So there's a lot going on in the choices of the symbols that they're defending. They've been given rally permits, and there's an argument to be made about free speech, but everyone knew going into this rally that it was going to be a violent rally, that people would come with weapons. There were tons of guns visible in downtown Charlottesville, and it's hard to argue that this is a space of free speech when it is so tied up in violence. One can't speak freely at the end of a gun, or at the end of a car, as the case may be. And I think that's what we saw in Charlottesville, was that it's hard to make a free speech argument when things are so imbalanced by the threat of violence and then by actual violence itself.
But all of the people that these demonstrators that came to Charlottesville were celebrating, waving their flags, and they were Ku Klux Klansmen. Their history is of absolute horrendous violence. They murdered, burned people alive. The Civil War was the most bloody event in this country's history. More people died per capita than much more in the Civil War than did in any of America's wars, by extraordinary factor. I mean, the casualty rate in the Civil War was horrendous. And then you've got these people with swastikas and Nazi paraphernalia celebrating this genocidal murderer, Adolf Hitler. So what the hell are they celebrating? Aren't they celebrating death, destruction, bloodshed, genocide?
Yes, and in defense of white power. I mean, there's no one who could have seen this event and not understood it as a defense of not just white nationalism, but violent white nationalism. I mean, white nationalism has always been violent. It's always taken some form of violence in order to hold together this power dynamic in which white people are on top. But what we saw was a very overt defense of that in a way that I don't think that we've really seen since the 1950s and 1960s in this country, that there is Nazi paraphernalia alongside Confederate paraphernalia. It's a shocking thing to see, but it has become an overt part of our politics, and we can't talk about it as a fringe political movement, because what we're seeing here in Charlottesville is not unconnected from what we're seeing in the White House, right? We see a president who not only was not willing to openly reject white supremacists both during the campaign and now during his administration, but who has surrounded himself with people who have affiliations with Richard Spencer, with the alt-right, and with neo-Nazi movements. And so what's happening here in Charlottesville is not a fringe thing. It's not irrelevant to what's happening in national politics. It's a microcosm of what we're experiencing in national politics. And so people need to pay attention. They need to understand the amount of violence that it took for them to make their case and to understand that that's not just something limited here to Charlottesville.
But when you use the word overt, I mean, it is overt. It used to be covert in the sense that the Ku Klux Klansmen wore hoods. But these people are out there in front of the cameras, courting the cameras, strutting their stuff, proud of their affiliations with the Nazis and with the Confederacy, etc. That's the change. And do you see a connection between the fact that white supremacists in this country now proudly strut their stuff? That's only happened recently, and it's something of a coincidence that it's happened since the emergence of Donald Trump.
Oh, I wouldn't call it a coincidence at all. I think that they've pretty openly acknowledged that they feel freed by Donald Trump. I mean, there was an article in the Daily Stormer, which is a white nationalist neo-Nazi publication, I think just yesterday, where they talked about the statement that Trump made, and they were gloating about it, saying, look, now we finally have a president who's not even going to denounce us, who's going to say that, well, both sides are to blame and not actually call anyone out. And that matters. It matters that you have a president who's not willing to openly denounce the organizations that are involved in these kinds of hate groups and incidents. And certainly the people involved in these groups understand that, and they feel empowered by it. Now, the Klan covered its face. Most white supremacist organizations throughout U.S. history, they haven't covered their faces, right? I mean, you have people like Robert Byrd, who was a U.S. senator and a member of the Ku Klux Klan. So it's not that all white supremacists have covered their faces, but that neo-Nazi groups feel comfortable being out and proud during the administration of Donald Trump is something worth noting. It's not a coincidence.
Well, just in closing, the Antifa, I guess, the other group, they got a lot of press, and they showed up there, or Black Bloc or whatever they are. It's hard to know who these people are. They're very secretive. They do cover their faces with balaclavas, etc. And they were involved with riots during the inauguration. They've had the unfortunate effect of equating the neo-Nazis with their form of provocative violence. But it doesn't look as if the people that were mowed down by the car, particularly the young woman from Charlottesville who was killed along with the 19, many of whom are very gravely injured, they weren't a part of the provocateurs in terms of the counter-demonstrations.
Right. I mean, I think it's very easy to lump all of these groups together, whereas the folks who were gathered in Emancipation Park were overtly identified with white nationalists. The groups that were counter-protesting, certainly there were anti-fascists involved, and some of those anti-fascists belonged to groups like the Black Bloc, who don't mind using violence in order to make their point. But you also had Black Lives Matter activists, you had members of the clergy, you had people who simply were anti-Nazi, which is not a terribly provocative viewpoint. And then you just had people down on the downtown mall who weren't activists at all. I mean, Charlottesville is a town that brings together a lot of people on a nice sunny weekend afternoon. So you had a broad group of people there, and even among the protesters, a broad group of people, very few of whom were committed to violence as a form of protest. There's been a lot of organization and activism in Charlottesville to determine what's the best way to respond to this. And by and large, the answer has been through nonviolence, but through visible and vocal protest. And that's largely what you saw here in Charlottesville on Saturday. And that it ended with violence was not the responsibility of anti-fascists, but was the responsibility of white nationalists.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Nicole Hemmer. I'm sorry that you had to witness such horror and that this whole thing took place. But I do hope that enough decent Americans are able to shame our president into recognizing that he is in bed with ugly people with an extremely ugly history. And it's just shameful.
I join you in that wish.
And again, I mean speaking with Nicole Hammer, who's a professor at the Miller Center for Public Affairs at the University of Virginia and a research associate at the U.S. Studies Center at the University of Sydney. She's the host of Past President Podcast and author of Messengers to the Right. Of the Right, Conservative Media and the Transformation of American Politics, and a contributor to U.S. News and World Report, where her latest article is Sounds and Silence in Charlottesville, the Violence of White Nationalism Spilled onto the Streets of Virginia. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back looking in. We'll be joined by somebody who will challenge the troubling remarks by the President of the United States, who implied that liberals and conservatives were equally violent.
Be good or be gone. Be good or be gone. You've been born with white skin. Explain and the Negro's name is used, it is plain, for the politician's gain as he rises to fame, and the poor white remains on the caboose of the train, but it ain't him to blame, he's only a pawn in our game.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Dr. Randy Blazak, who is the chair of the Coalition Against Hate Crime and a sociologist at the University of Oregon, who has spent almost three decades studying white supremacists. His latest book is Hate Offenders. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Randy Blazak.
Hi, nice to be here.
And these troubling remarks by the President of the United States implying that liberals and conservatives are equally violent, it's not, I mean, the President actually went out of his way to emphasize that the hate, bigotry, and violence on display in Charlottesville came from many sides. He repeated many sides. So I find it extremely troubling that this is a President who has never denounced any of the acts of white supremacists and the associations with his campaign, the fact that he has members of the alt-right in the highest positions inside his own White House, and in the broader sense, that if you watch what these demonstrators were saying or heard what they were saying as they chanted, you will not replace us and Jews will not replace us. All of this is in the context of this peculiar phenomenon where there's this narrative, which I think the White House is also helping encourage, that white men are oppressed in this country.
You know, this is something that started before this man was even elected to the office. I mean, this is the guy who doubted the legitimacy of the black president. And one of his less known tweets was a complaint about the TV show Blackish. And if there had been a TV show called Whitish, it would be racist. And so this is a, you know, a common frame of mind among many white people who don't understand the context of racism and racial oppression and oppression in general. They just see things as tilting away from the status quo, which means somehow they're going to become oppressed. So equality to them is reframed as oppression, and that somehow these white men are the new minority, these guys marching in Virginia who, you know, feel so horribly oppressed because of all the changes in society. I mean, this is sort of the core of Trump's base. And I wrote about this 2 years ago. I can't believe we've been talking about this for so long, but 2 years ago in my blog, Watching the Wheels, when I started noticing the rhetoric that Trump was using on the campaign trail from the very beginning was the same rhetoric I would hear when I was doing my research on white supremacist groups. It was almost lifted from some Klan speeches that I saw in Georgia one day about blaming things on illegal immigrants and pulling out one particular example of an illegal immigrant doing something horrible and then casting dispersions on everybody who's here undocumented. I mean, these scapegoating techniques and these sort of generalizations and conspiracies, that's the bread and the butter of the white supremacist movement. And he's just sort of capitalized on that simplistic way of thinking and used it to, I think, pull a lot of people who are a little bit, you know, not in the margins of the sort of racist subcultures that we think about when we think about neo-Nazis, but are kind of sort of fellow travelers and giving them a voice, giving this silent minority this re-fantasized image of themselves as the silent majority, or maybe a noisy minority would be a better way to characterize it. So it's really moves the dialogue in this country to the right. And he, whether knowingly or unknowingly, has been the catapult for that shift to the right. I mean, sometimes I think this guy just is sort of clueless and he, you know, reads whatever piece of paper Steve Bannon puts in front of his face. But he has been an agent of this incredible shift to the right. And the rhetoric about make America great again, that word again is very important to a lot of these people. It's, you know, 1950 before all the civil rights legislation started ruining it for the white man. And they want to go back to that. And in fact, Trump in a CNN interview said, when somebody said, when is again in your slogan, he said it was the early 50s. So there you have it. It wasn't great for a lot of people.
Well, but it's not just Stephen Bannon and Stephen Miller, close White House aides. There's Sebastian Gorka, who Trump apparently thinks is just the greatest. He loves him on TV. He's has deep associations with Hungarian fascists. You got this nut job that McMaster finally was able to fire from the National Security Council. Wiggins, who wrote this amazing memo with all of this delusion that America is being taken over by Marxists and bankers, which of course is code for Jews.
Right.
You had in the chants in the demonstrations of these neo-Nazis with their torchlight Nazi-like parade on Friday night in Charlottesville, you will not replace us and Jews will not replace us. I mean, that demonstration brought violence to Charlottesville, resulting in the death of a young woman. Two police officers were killed in a helicopter crash as well, and 19 people were seriously injured when this white supremacist plowed into a group of innocent people. Now, it's true that they were the nut jobs on the left, if that's where they're from, the black bloc anarchists, and they, to some extent, were able to let people like Trump get away with this equation that was violence on all sides, when it was clearly the violence was brought by the Unite the Right group. But the people that came there to protest with the Unite the Right represented the most genocidal people in history, the Nazis. They represented the Confederacy, which resulted in a civil war that killed more Americans per capita than any event in the history of this country, including all the wars combined. The Ku Klux Klan weren't a bunch of guys out on a Friday night lighting torches and having barbecues. They were murdering, killing, burning alive black people for decades in this country. So,
yeah. And that's entirely true, but you have a historical perspective that I don't think many people do. So what happens, you have to kind of take it down to the local moment of somebody turning on the 6 o'clock news, and what do they see? They see fascist and anti-fascist battling out in the streets. And so that's their picture of the world. And they don't see the fascists as representing the status quo or having this connection to, you know, all this murderous violence. They see them as protesters on one side and protesters on the other side who are equally engaged in some type of football match where they're doing battle and who's going to win the match today without the larger context. And that's often the problem with a lot of racism in America. For example, people will say, well, they have Black History Month. Why don't they have White History Month? Well, you have to understand the context of the history of racism, and that every month is White History Month. And that's why February, the shortest, coldest month, is Black History Month. And so without the context, it looks like these are just two equal sides of a coin, you know, one side on one side and one side on the other doing battle. And you have to educate people, as you sort of very eloquently did in a few sentences there, that these are not two equal teams. They are a team that's fighting for equality and some type of balance in our society, and another team that's fighting against that to maintain the status quo. And so, we can oversimplify it a lot in terms of football matches and things like that, but it's a very insidious problem in our thinking among white Americans to think that the race problem is solved, the gender problem is solved, the sexual orientation problem is solved. There are white people who think that because we had a black president, there's no more real racism anymore. It's just, you know, affectation of some past fantasy. And so there is real work to be done to bring those people over, because I think Charlottesville is a tipping point. I think a lot of people are going to look at it and be horrified and want to reject the direction the alt-right wants to drag this country. But there are still going to be those people who feel like this is the last chance to save America from whatever conspiracy, including the anti-Semitic conspiracy theories that these guys buy into, that feel like this is our last chance. And when you do the work that I do and you spend some time in their world, including in their online world, you see this kind of apocalyptic moment that they believe is upon us, that if Trump is their last chance at saving America for the WASPs. Trump is their last chance of holding globalization at bay and restoring America for, you know, for white people and going back to 1950. And so that there's a very dangerous moment we're in, where we're at risk of tipping over to the other side and handing over power to these people who want to make sure that the other side doesn't have a right to vote or is disenfranchised because they have a felony conviction or because they've moved into a county that has now been gerrymandered out of the Democratic stronghold. And so I don't want to overemphasize how important Charlottesville is, but I think besides all the soul searching that's going on right now, there is a real fork in the road that we're at. And we're going to have to figure out which way the country is going to go. And I don't think we can depend on our president to lead us down the right way, because he seems to be completely clueless at how politics works and how the country works. And so it's going to be up to the rest of us to maybe bring him to the right side and not follow him, because he's certainly no leader, at least on this issue.
Well, he may even be complicitous with the alt-right. Sure. And the white nationalists. That's the indication he's given, because he will not, he'll go go to town on the drop of a hat against Islamists and Muslims and all this stuff.
Yeah, and I don't doubt he will come out of his little clubhouse, his vacation in Pennsylvania there, with a pre-prepared speech that he's going to read about how racism is bad and how he disavows David Duke and the Ku Klux Klan,
right,
and all that.
Finally.
It's sort of empty rhetoric.
Right.
It's sort of empty rhetoric. Right. And, you know, if he really wants to convince us, he needs to talk about the reality of racism, including within law enforcement and all the other permutations of it. But also, the best thing that he could do today is purge his cabinet and purge his White House of all these alt-right folks that are in it. He wants to send a real message. He wants to fire people, which he seems to like to do. Fire those folks. And that would be the start of some indication that he realizes he was going down the wrong road. That would be a very powerful thing. And I've been doing a lot of this talking in the last 24 hours about what the president could do. And I don't think there would be anything more symbolic of him recognizing that, whoops, you know, I took the wrong turn on that off-ramp, than getting rid of those people and getting rid of them in one fell swoop, saying they're out and we're gonna try a different course. I don't think it'll happen, but
right. Well, I don't think it'll happen, because everything he does is he panders to his shrinking minority now at about 35%.
Right.
He started out on the first day when he announced he's running, prior to which, of course, he engaged in the racist jihad against President Obama, accusing him of not having a birth certificate, etc. Then the first thing he does out of the gate when he announces he's running is he does a racist and a gratuitous attack on Mexicans. Frankly, this is they have been using dog whistles throughout the entire campaign and throughout their presidency. And the dog whistle has been answered in Charlottesville by all these neo-Nazis. You can't have it both ways. And I think there's also a cynical element to this, Dr. Randy Blazak, and that is that if the If all of the people who are being screwed in this country, minorities and the oppressed whites or the imaginary oppressed whites, if they could recognize how much they have in common in terms of the economic downsizing from globalism and all of the things that worry them and the growth of an American plutocracy, they would recognize they have so much more in common than they do that separates them. And I believe that these cynical people like the Koch brothers and the Mercers and all of these plutocrats running America, they're perfectly happy to sow division and to keep racism alive.
Yeah, and I think that points to the failure of the Clinton campaign in making that case to the American worker, to the people in Michigan and Wisconsin, that it's not the illegal immigrants, who are, of course, always brown people, who are the ones that are responsible for their economic downturn. So that case really has to be made. I mean, and of course, that goes way back. I mean, the Ku Klux Klan were, way back to the beginning, were mostly poor whites who were taking their anger out on free slaves instead of the people who, you know, were owning the land that they couldn't work on. So that divide and conquer is a constant theme in our struggle. But the ability to make that argument is so compounded by social media and just the power of a meme that's based on some unreal fact or some misconstrued news story that can immediately turn people against each other instead of unifying them. And so they didn't have this problem in the 1870s that we've got now, that it's harder to appeal to people on that intellectual level when they've got some juicy story of an illegal immigrant that's killed a white girl to motivate them to follow their charismatic leader. So, I mean, it's a new chapter of an old story, but we're still struggling against trying to get people to think before they vote instead of feel before they vote. And it's, you know, not always easy.
Right. But the better angels have emerged against slavery, against racism, providing against misogyny, getting the women's vote, getting rid of child labor, getting rid of Jim Crow, et cetera. Not that it's still, the vestiges are still alive. So
there are bent towards justice.
Yeah.
The issue is, I'm sorry to interrupt, the issue is, and all the measures, as a sociologist, I can tell you, is that the measures are generally good. We're less racist, we're less homophobic in general. We're moving in a positive direction. The population is changing. We're going to be a much more brown nation, and these alt-right guys can't stop that. We're becoming more diverse every single day, and this younger generation is the most diverse ever. So the future looks bright. The problem is that these guys feel so left out of that change that they are getting angrier and angrier. They're smaller and smaller in terms of their percentage of the population, but they're getting angrier and angrier. And all of a sudden, we've got, you know, Timothy McVeighs popping up all over the place who believe that this is the last chance to save America for the people who, quote unquote, created it, meaning white men, and that they're willing to do large scale violence to preserve it. And so as we move in these opposite directions, the real risk of right-wing extremist violence, like we saw in Oklahoma City, is very, very real. And I think it's getting more real every day. And I think Virginia this weekend is the turning point. You know, are these people going to see the person who drove that car into a hero or as a terrorist? Well, there's going to be some. And there are a small group that see him as a hero and want more of that. And that's what we have to be on guard against.
Well, Randy Blazek, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking to Dr. Randy Blazek, who's the chair of the Coalition Against Hate Crime and a sociologist at the University of Oregon, who has spent almost three decades studying white supremacists. His latest book is Hate Offenders. We're going to take a brief station break and be back with an assessment of the extent to which Trump's threat of military action against Venezuela is playing into the hands of the Maduro government. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Jennifer McCoy, the Distinguished University Professor of Political Science at Georgia State University and previously Director of the Carter Center's Project on Mediation and Monitoring in Venezuela. She directed election monitoring projects for the Carter Center in Nicaragua, Panama, Mexico, Jamaica, Peru, and Venezuela. And she's also edited or contributed to several books on the topic of Venezuelan democracy, most recently, International Mediation in Venezuela. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jennifer McCoy.
Thank you, Ian. Glad to be here.
Well, thank you, Jennifer. And President Trump at his golf club in Bedminster, New Jersey, the other day in a photo op and a brief address to the press, flanked by his UN representative, Nikki Haley, his Secretary of State, and his National Security Advisor, General McMaster, said, "We have many options for Venezuela, and by the way, I'm not going to rule out a military option. A military operation and a military option is certainly something that we would pursue." And then he went on to say, "Venezuela is not very far away, and the people are suffering and they are dying. And we have many options for Venezuela, including possibly military option if necessary." So when I watched that, my jaw dropped, but I also noticed standing right next to him, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson flinched. I don't know whether you could read much into that body language, but it seems to just have come out of nowhere. Do you have any idea of what prompted the president to make such an outrageous, ill-timed, ill-considered statement that's basically a gift to Venezuela's President Maduro?
Well, I imagine that he was thinking in broad terms. There has been obviously much discussion about North Korea and keeping all the options on the table, particularly with a response to any North Korean aggression. And in that context, may have just been referring to there is a range of options that the U.S. always has. However, I think most serious observers of the United States foreign policy decisions would think that military options for Venezuela would be quite far down the list. I would almost rule that out in terms of the actual probability of such an action, unless it were to evacuate American citizens endangered, which, for example, was the reason for the invasion of Grenada back in the 1980s, at least the reason given. But I think it would be quite far down the list, and I don't know why he said it other than that he was thinking about it in this larger sense of North Korea and others.
But his National Security Advisor, General H.R. McMaster, who was standing on the other side of Rex Tillerson next to Nikki Haley, only a week ago, last Saturday, said that he didn't want to give Maduro any ammunition to blame the Yankees for the tragedy that had befallen this oil-rich country. Quoting McMaster, "You see Maduro have some lame attempts to try to do that already." So McMaster clearly gets it, and he must have been even more shocked than Tillerson appeared to be.
Well, I would certainly think that this comment was ill-advised, and whether anyone knew he was going to make it or if it was off the cuff, you know, I don't know. But certainly it gives ammunition to President Maduro as a justification for things that he and President Chavez said for many years. The possibility of U.S. invasion was justification for arming a civilian militia in Venezuela, which there is, and they have bought many arms, weapons from Russia to arm civilians. With threats like these. So it certainly does not help the context of trying to arrive to a negotiated solution to the conflict, the political conflict ongoing in the humanitarian crisis in Venezuela.
But Jennifer McCoy, are you referring to the colectivos, the pro-government vigilante groups that are on?
No, I'm afraid there are two things, civilians. Well, look, there are three things. First, there are just a lot of private weapons, handguns, et cetera, in Venezuela among civilians to protect themselves because the crime rate is extremely high. But second, there are the gangs, the armed gangs, which are referred to as the colectivos, which started out actually as communal groups organizations to help people, particularly in the poor neighborhoods. But some of those have developed into these armed motorcycle gangs, which are loosely affiliated with the governing party, with the government. But it's not clear that they are under the control or the direction of the armed forces or the government. Third, Hugo Chavez started what he called a private, a civilian militia, which was to be trained in the event that there was an external invasion or an internal threat, armed threat. And that, has been for the last 10 years or so. And Maduro said he was going to arm, to enlarge that civilian militia. And those people, receive long arms and some training, and it's unclear exactly the extent of their training or what they would be prepared to do. I have seen them helping to monitor polling places because the armed forces are in charge of security during elections. So I've seen them there, peacefully, but there as part of the security forces.
But the one thing that seems to be counterproductive in both the North Korean situation and in this situation with Venezuela is if you're dealing with Kim Jong-un, whose his regime and his father's and grandfather's regime have just been over the top in the hyperbole about the American imperialists threatening them, and so has Chavez and so has Maduro. They just are continually pumping out this chorus of hyperbole about the American threat. And to hand it to them, I mean, just in terms of hyperbole, Nicolas Maduro's son, Nicolas Maduro, said today, if the impossible scenario, talking about the idea of the Yankee invasion, if the impossible scenario of tarnishing our fatherland were ever to occur, our guns would arrive to New York and we would take the White House. Solve your own problems, Donald Trump. You have enough. So that's what he's. That's what our president is feeding into. I mean, do you have a sense that, everybody takes some solace in the idea that there are a few adults in the room, the generals, and a new general now as his chief of staff. But again, if you contrast what Trump said in this kind of off-the-cuff threat of using the military option in Venezuela with what McMaster, his national security advisor, said only a week ago, it would lead one to conclude that the adults in the room aren't necessarily in the room.
Well, certainly the hyperbole is there. The war of words is there. It's completely unrealistic, to think that Venezuelans would be arriving to either New York or to Washington, to the White House, to attack. And I have always told the Venezuelans that the threat of a U.S. invasion of Venezuela was completely unrealistic. In fact, I'll tell you a personal anecdote. When I was talking with President Chavez some years ago, and he had just given a national, speech referring to the possibility of U.S. invasion and helicopters coming and how he would respond, he actually said to me afterwards, maybe I overdid it in that. And I said, yes, I think you did overdo it. I mean, he was completely aware that of the, the political motivations for giving such a speech. Again, for raising the levels of fear within the country. And so when you hear from the United States president the actual possibility of such an option, which most people consider quite low, that does raise the fear, the paranoia, within some in Venezuela. The other thing it does is produce a reaction among other Latin American governments who we had just been moving toward a much more coordinated response to Venezuela. And now, as we saw already, the Chilean response, they have to react against that because of the history of U.S. armed intervention or supporting armed or, illegal, unconstitutional actions like military coups in the past, much more in the distant past. So it breaks down again or harms our efforts to have a coordinated response to Venezuela today.
Well, Mike Pence is off today, as a matter of fact, on a four-nation tour of Latin America, stopping in Colombia first. Colombia's foreign minister condemned Donald Trump's remarks, saying military measures and the use of force should resolve Venezuela's crisis, and it should be peaceful, and we should respect its sovereignty. I mean, what damage has been done to that cohesion that you just told us about?
Well, I'm sure that will be a subject of discussion, and hopefully Vice President Pence will, you know, be reassuring them that that is, you know, way down the list, of possibilities in order to renew or reassure the Latin American governments with whom we had been, as I said, moving toward a more collaborative and coordinated response, which needs to focus on a humanitarian response. And reassuring the Venezuela government that, you know, providing humanitarian needs does not threaten the Venezuelan government. I think that's absolutely critical, that we've got to focus on the humanitarian crisis and the economic crisis to try to help the country before it falls even further down the cliff of where it is now in terms of economic and social situation. And then to help, hopefully, to arrive at a negotiated political solution to the standoff and to protect human rights and to restore the constitutionality of separation of powers and everything else.
Well, Venezuela is poised on the brink of default, and a lot of the default, of course, would be the Chinese. The debt to China is substantial. I believe it's something like $60 billion. China has been sort of propping them up. But curiously enough, the people that are keeping Venezuela from an immediate default through debt swaps are Goldman Sachs. So what do you think? Is that the next shoe that could drop?
I think there are three actors that are absolutely crucial when we're talking about the international debt. The sort of lenders of last resort are China and Russia. And Russia is a very important lender and in April made another billion-dollar loan and has collateral for those loans in the form of joint ventures in Venezuela, but also Citgo in the United States. The Venezuelan government gave Russia, as collateral for the loans, the eventual possibility of 49% of Citgo in the United States. So that Russia and China's loans are in exchange for oil. So that's how Venezuela repays China. And the decisions those two countries make in terms of further loans will be crucial. The private international bondholders and private companies like Goldman Sachs are also very important. And there was a lot of discussion and controversy over the recent purchase of bonds at a great discounted rate, so that, you know, Venezuela as a country is kind of mortgaging its future with all of this borrowing and from China and Russia and selling the bonds at a greatly discounted rate in order to get an immediate cash infusion, which is the government's goal right now, not only to pay for its current imports of food and medicine and everything else it's importing, including, by the way, gasoline from the United States, which they import, and lightweight crude in order to make their heavy crude more sellable. So it's mortgaging kind of the future of Venezuela for those immediate payment needs for imports, as well as the upcoming payments due in November, loan payments due from the oil company PDVSA. So those are the government's sort of immediate needs for international infusion of cash.
Well, if Vice President Mike Pence, of course, does appear to be to some extent doing damage control, and he's going to Colombia today. Colombia has been impacted by the crisis in Venezuela. I saw news footage of average Venezuelans with their worldly possessions crossing the bridges into Colombia, and in many in tears, leaving their own country with great reluctance, but out of necessity. It's a real tragedy, and there, of course, there have been a lot of cross-border smuggling of gasoline, and people go across from Venezuela into Colombia to buy milk and tampons and everything else that they can't, toilet paper, stuff that they can't get. So This is a real humanitarian crisis. This is a government from an oil-rich country that has really blown it. And I don't understand the kind of sort of mealy-mouth confusion on the political left, particularly with people like Jeremy Corbyn, who was challenged by his undying support for Chavez and Maduro in the face of what's happening in the country. What's your explanation for that? Because it can't, if people on the left believe in socialism, these idiots in Venezuela are giving socialism a bad name.
Well, you're exactly right. And I would say the left, you know, globally is divided on how to react to this case, because Hugo Chavez did start a movement that he called a revolutionary movement, and that he invented the term 21st century socialism, which did enamor a lot of people with the possibility of redistributing oil wealth to the poor, but also empowering them through cooperatives and, you know, new forms of education and productivity, and also standing up to the United States, which was an important part of his policy, and creating a more multipolar world. So many people on the left, you know, intellectually supported some of those goals. And a third goal was creating a new form of direct democracy and communal democracy. But it has gone very badly awry over the years, and Chavez left a legacy of great difficulty for Maduro, and then Maduro had an oil collapse, and the inability to make the decisions or impose the economic decisions to correct the situation. So, you know, we now have, as you said, a humanitarian crisis, a tragedy, and all of the countries, the neighboring countries in Latin America, the United States, the Caribbean islands, that will be directly affected if there is a refugee crisis. Certainly many people are leaving already. The numbers seeking asylum in the United States have jumped tremendously this year from Venezuela, and they are going also to Peru, to Mexico, and certainly across the border to Colombia, you know, huge traffic of people going back and forth, as you said, you know, even just to look for food and medicine. So that's why the hemisphere is certainly concerned to solve this country. The left, you know, there are some that are still, I think, overshadowed in their thinking by their criticism of U.S. imperialism and U.S. foreign policy and intervention in the past. And that seems to be coloring their view about what's happening now, is my only explanation for that.
But Trump certainly helped fuel that, didn't he? That's why his remarks are so ridiculous.
Yeah, it does help fuel that, yeah. But we're seeing people speaking out, even within Venezuela, even from within the opposition. You know, there are certainly some saying, you know, this is not the solution that we want.
Sure. Well, it is an irony that in raising up the poor, they brought down the rest of the population and made them poor. So it's hardly a success, even though the intentions were, and the country has, of course, always had a ruling elite for as long as we can remember. But this situation is blatantly unsupportable, and our president is making things so much worse. It's really quite tragic. I thank you for joining us, Sir Jennifer McCoy.
Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Jennifer McCoy, who's a distinguished university professor of political science at Georgia State University and previously directed the Carter Center's project on mediation and monitoring in Venezuela. She directed election monitoring projects for the Carter Center in Nicaragua, Panama, Mexico, Jamaica, Peru, and Venezuela. And she also edited or contributed to several books on the topic of Venezuelan democracy, most recently, International Mediation in Venezuela.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasts at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.